I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's public lecture, which is being given by one of my Department of Economic History colleagues, since I am, had time to do academic things, was an economic historian. I hope I will be again in the future. Tonight's lecture by Professor Nick Craft, The Economic Impact of ICT, A Perspective from the Age of STEAM. Before the lecture, let me tell you a bit about Nick Craft. I could tell you a lot about Nick because about 23 years ago, he generously nursed my PhD thesis through to completion. And nursing any PhD thesis through to completion is always a bit of a struggle, both for the student and the supervisor. And Nick helped me along the way tremendously with that, though there were one or two moments in the process when I thought I might not make it because I had all this wonderful intellectual input from Nick over a pint of beer or two in the pub, and then I would forget what all the suggestions were, and somehow those gems slipped by me. As I say, I could say a lot about Nick from 20-odd years ago, or indeed for the intervening 20 years, but perhaps what I should say more specifically is about Nick's achievements, because he is undoubtedly the preeminent economic historian in the country. He was a fellow in economics at University College back in the late 70s and early 80s, then Professor of Economic History, first at the University of Leeds, then at the University of Warwick, before coming here to LSE in 1995 as Professor of Economic History. He's a Fellow of the British Academy, an academician of the Social Sciences, President of the Economic History Society, author of something over 150 books, articles and chapters on the field of economic history. It's difficult to be more specific because Nick has written on just about all aspects of the economic history of Britain over the last 250 or 300 years. One of his perhaps most significant achievements in the course of this tremendous intellectual journey is to completely rewrite the history of the British Industrial Revolution. The very concept, the very term Industrial Revolution suggests something, some great dramatic event, some fundamental and rapid restructuring of the way in which the economy works. Nick, through a series of papers and books, has redrawn our understanding of the Industrial Revolution. What he has shown is that it was a long, drawn-out process. It was slow. It was initially rather concentrated in particular sectors. It did have a profound impact both on Britain and the rest of the world, but it was very much more an evolution rather than a revolution. And that fundamental recasting of the British Industrial Revolution has been profoundly important, not just for economic historians, but for our general understanding of the way in which Britain developed over the period from about 1750. But Nick's contributions aren't just in relation to the Industrial Revolution period. He's written extensively on post-war growth and more recently on various aspects of globalization. In the best traditions of economic historians at LSE, he uses his expertise and knowledge of historical growth processes to comment both on the present and the future. And in fact, that's very much what he's going to do, I think, with this evening's lecture, which taking an historical perspective to look at the contemporary challenges and effects of information and communications technology. Despite all this fantastic and tremendous intellectual output, Nick also has time for, apparently, so he claims, for recreation. In Who's Who, he lists his particular recreations as drinking beer and betting on horses. But these aren't just trivial bits of recreation. He has turned some of these interests to academic effect. In 1985, he wrote an article in Economica called Some Evidence of Insider Knowledge in Horse Race Betting in Britain. It was, of course, his own insider knowledge that he was writing up at the time. He hasn't, to my knowledge, written any academic papers on beer or the brewing industry. And, of course, given the time of day, we might well find our thoughts moving towards beer and drinking activities. But before we do that, we have the privilege of listening to Nick, Nick's thoughts on ICT and lessons from the past. Nick, over to you.
Thank you, Paul. I've often wondered what it would be like to read one's obituary. I've got a slight flavour now. I hope you don't know something I don't. Okay. Let me move then to the topic of the talk, the economic impact of ICT, perspective from the age of STEAM. I see that some of the audience here are people who I've been teaching this year. I hope there's a very substantial amount of revision here, and I trust that there's no contradiction. We don't want you to leave confused. In fact, one or two of you have been guinea pigs for one or two of the ideas in these slides, and I'm grateful for the feedback I've had. I haven't really changed my mind, but you made me think at least. Okay, let me announce right from the outset, as is always my way, there won't be any jokes, because jokes are no longer politically correct. So I think instead of a joke to start the proceedings, I'd better have a mission statement. Mission statements are still allowed. And here's my mission statement for this evening. Economic history, a perspective from economic history, can help make better sense of today's world. Almost Paul's words a few moments ago. I think he's been peeking at this slide. And leaders not to overreact to changes in the economic environment. Several of the things I'm going to talk about are changes which some people have hyped up quite a lot. Okay, let me kick off then with general purpose technologies, which I'm going to suggest both ICT and STEAM would qualify as two of the most important general purpose technologies of the past 200 years or so. As we know, those sorts of technologies are essentially pervasive. They're used very widely in the economy. Having said that, they're probably not particularly productive initially. Their effects come through with a lag. When those effects do start to come through, then I'm going to suggest that the stock market tends to get very excited by them. And that's going to be part of the story that I mention. Eventually, they'll come to be widely used, and they'll have quite a big impact on productivity growth. I want to say something about how big that impact might be. But initially, the impact of these technologies may be negligible, or even may involve a slowdown in economic growth. So that the starting point for any lecture like this, I guess, has pretty much got to be the Solow productivity paradox, which everyone here, I think, will have come across. You can see the computer age everywhere except in the productivity statistics. A statement which seemed quite reasonable in 1987, or at least lots of people latched onto it. By 1997, clearly that wouldn't have been a good description. By 1997, the paradox was definitely deceased. It was not pining for the fjords, it was deceased. But the fact that Solow put that statement up, I think is quite interesting. And for me, actually, it indicates a lack of perspective, a lack of historical perspective. And I'll come back to that in a moment. If we think of STEAM as a general purpose technology, I think there are three aspects to it that I want to draw to your attention. Steam engines, railways, and steam ships. Notice that railways and steam ships are transportation improvements. The railway and the steamship together were globalizing. And so after I've talked a bit about the contribution of these technologies to growth, reflected on the stock market, I then want to say a word or two about the globalization impacts of these technologies in the past compared with ICT now. Let's start with steam then. We probably, all of us, think of James Watt as some kind of founding father of the steam engine. His patent dates from 1769. It's not the first steam engine, of course, but it's an improved version, and it's the one that captures the imagination. Again, to get the chronology, the first important commercial railway was the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, opened in 1830. And if we're thinking of steamships, this wasn't commercial, but we could cross the Atlantic by steamship in 1838. Not a major commercial triumph. If you did that, you had to have the ship completely full of coal. This was a bit like Concorde, only worse, I suppose. Fortunately, the steamship within 20 years had been developed to the point at which commercial payload could go. And by, say, 1870, 3,000 miles was about the commercial range. It got bigger afterwards. Now, the first thing I want to say about steam is just to make the point that its impact was quite long delayed, I think. If we look at sources of power in the British economy, between 1760 and the first census of production in 1907, then it's a long time really before there's very much horsepower being used at all in machinery. In 1830, only 350,000 horsepower altogether. By then, steam has just drawn level with water. They each have about 165,000 horsepower. And it's only from that point on that steam really starts to dominate. And the first point I want to suggest is that the real age of steam is after 1850, not before. We tend to think of steam in the Industrial Revolution. It is, of course, there. The pioneers are working at it. But the true age of steam is after the point at which we normally think the Industrial Revolution has been completed. You think about that, just think how many horsepower you've got in the vehicles that collectively you own in this room, and you realise that 350,000 is not a big number. So why did steam engines take a long time to break through and fully to take over? Well, I think an economic historian's always going to be likely to say it's probably because they weren't very cost effective initially, and I think that's the answer here too. It took a long time to improve the technology to the point where they were widely cost-effective. One of the simplest ways of getting hold of that, I think, is just to look at the coal consumption of steam engines. In terms of pounds per horsepower per hour, James Watt got it down to about 12.5 pounds. By, say, the middle of the 19th century, we're probably starting to see the best steam engines getting down to 7 or 8 pounds. And by 1900, high-performance steam engines down to 2 pounds. At the same time, the key to this, as you can see, is that steam was worked with much higher pressure. So the real breakthrough, I think, as an economic technology, was the move to high-pressure steam engines after 1850. And it's not until that point that the investment really takes off. I think spillovers are something I'll leave for questions if asked. Come back to that if you want and I'll tell you about it. But time is ticking on. We'll go to a pretty chart. There we have some indication of how steam got cheaper over time. These are measured in current pounds, yet there are periods when prices go up and down a little bit. I'm not sure I've got a good index to deal with that. It's probably not really very misleading. Let's stick to the current pounds. If we do, then notice that the annual cost of running steam horsepower by 1910 was of the order of 1/8 of what it had been in 1760. You might want to bear that in mind, because I'm going to make a contrast with it in just a moment. If you then do the standard growth accounting exercise and look at steam's contributions in terms of steam horsepower in use, the extent to which total factor productivity in the production of steam was actually increasing and so on, then we get a graph which I think tells much of the story. The peak impact in terms of impact on growth per year of labour productivity was in the third quarter of the 19th century. It's after 1850. By now, railways and steamships are starting to contribute. By now, the steam engine is starting to diffuse much more widely. The contribution, even in the last years before the First World War, is appreciably above anything in the Industrial Revolution. And I haven't tried to cheat on the scale here. I've had to work very hard to get it to come up above the horizontal axis. The contribution of steam before 1830 is quite small indeed. That's not a new finding, and I think I should immediately say, when I created these numbers, I was only confirming something that Nick von Tunzelmann had shown even in the 1970s, but without perhaps seeing what the follow-through implications would be. This, I think, gives us another reason for what Paul was talking about. It's another reason why the Industrial Revolution is not this spectacular cataclysmic event that it once was described as. Steam is a technology that takes a long time to pay off. It's not there to deliver the big punch to drive productivity forward in the Industrial Revolution. Well, you said I wanted to hear about ICT, not about steam. Well, fair enough. In that case, why not have the equivalent picture for the contribution of ICT to American labour productivity growth in the years since the mid-1970s? I think we could argue when we think the ICT revolution really begins. I'm going to suggest that perhaps the equivalent of James Watt is something like the microchip, and if so, it's about 1971. So I'm going to take the start of this era, the equivalent of 1769, for argument's sake this afternoon, is 1971. In that case, notice that the contribution to US labor productivity growth in the first years up to 1990 was already above 0.5% a year. That immediately, I think, indicates something about what I have in mind with regard to Solow, that his expectations were too big, would be my way of thinking about this. At this point, the capital stock attributable to ICT is still a small part of the economy, as it's bound to be, and so indeed is the ICT production industry. Rates of improvement are rapid, but the weight that it has in the economy is very small. And in that sense, we see something which is a faster rate of improvement than steam, but still not able to dominate the economy overall. As we move towards the present, then we observe that the contribution accelerates, and accelerates very markedly after the mid-1990s. I think that is now accepted as a break point, although econometricians no doubt can always argue, and an economic historian can no doubt, as usual, say it's too soon to tell. Nevertheless, I'm going to stick my neck out and say I think there is a genuine acceleration at that point. And it's an acceleration which starts to take the contribution to productivity growth well over 1% a year, perhaps over 1.5% a year. Remember, the peak steam contribution I suggested was about 0.4% a year. There's a difference, of course, between contribution per year and total cumulative effect at the end of the story. We don't yet know what ICT's contribution will be. We're perhaps at half-time, we're perhaps only at the end of the first quarter. It's difficult to say. It's possible to suppose that perhaps it won't in its entirety match steam, but I think that gets a bit harder each year. And I think this per annum impact is telling us something. Why has the impact been so strong so quickly? Well, the answer, I think, is in that sort of graph, that piece of information, which attempts to measure the real cost of computing in terms of machine instructions per second. It's a data set put together by William Nordhaus, who's done some very useful work in measuring progress through time in this way. He shows that computing in 1950 was no cheaper than in 1850, but since then, the real cost of computing has nosedived. If you're good at sums, you'll come up with the answer that its cost in 2000 is getting close to 1/1,000,000,000th of what it was in 1950. That's an awful lot of noughts. Remember, steam over the years 1760 to 1910, over 150 years, its real cost falls by about 7/8. Impressive, but nothing like this. This is what drives forward, then, the very rapid adoption of ICT. This is what makes the investments worthwhile, and this reflects a phenomenal rate of technological change. I dare say colleagues in the department will come up with examples, and we'll see if they can, but I cannot think of any historical parallel to Moore's Law. What is the same about the ICT experience is the weight of ICT in the economy at the start is small, and that delays its full impact. What is extraordinary is the very, very rapid growth of productivity due to technological change. So, my talk is divided into three parts, and at the end of the first part, we should probably have a commercial break at this stage, but don't think we're set up for that, We've got the following as the one-third the way through score. I'm going to suggest the impacts of general purpose technologies on growth, that ICT has been having a bigger effect on the US recently than steam ever had on the UK, even at its highest point. Secondly, and going with that, the costs of computing have fallen much faster than did the costs of steam power. And a third bullet here is a conjecture. Perhaps this tells us that society is getting better at exploiting general purpose technologies more rapidly. If we were to put in the intervening case of electricity, which I've not got lots of graphs relating to, then I think we'd find the progression goes steam, slow, electricity faster, ICT rather rapid. That seems to be the pattern. If we were saying that society is getting better, what might be the reasons? I think it might be to do with the human capital that we have in the economy now, and the education system, and the basic stock of knowledge. All of those are hugely better than in the Industrial Revolution. Maybe we should also say incentive structures have improved. In various ways, the incentives to do R&D, for example, may be quite a lot better than they were in 1850. On the other hand, you can always have an on the other hand. We haven't had one yet this evening. Here it comes. On the other hand, it may simply be the inherent degree of difficulty in these technologies. Perhaps steam really was incredibly hard. We would have struggled with it today, whereas ICT is really quite easy. I'm inclined not to accept that hypothesis, but I suppose I can't explicitly reject it. Let me turn now towards the stock market side of things. We ought to have a bit of excitement now, I think. Well, there's always excitement to be had when punters are greedy and lose a lot of money. So just as with the dot-coms in 2000 or thereabouts, people who speculated in railway shares in the mid-1840s got their fingers burned pretty badly as well. You probably know that in order to establish a railway in Britain, these are data for Britain, you had to have parliamentary approval, and these were the amounts of capital authorised in parliamentary acts. You can see that suddenly, around 1844-5-6, there's a massive burst of enthusiasm. Projects are being proposed everywhere. After 1846, notice it falls away, and by the end of the 1840s, the enthusiasm seems rather less. Admittedly, with that capital, by 1852, the main railway network of the UK, the core 7,000 miles or so, was in place. But what had happened in the meantime was punters who were in for railway shares took quite a serious beating. I should have offered a health warning at the start of the lecture that nothing in this lecture, of course, should be construed either as the opinion of the LSE, still less as financial advice. But I could offer you a bit of financial advice. Don't buy railway shares in the autumn of 1845. I think I'm allowed that, and no regulator is going to slap my wrist, but we'll wait and see the first writ arrive tomorrow. It's even true, in fact, if you look at the companies which eventually were very successful indeed by 19th century standards, their share prices took a bath as well. These were the two big winners, if you like, out of the whole railway episode. Over the next 25 years, their share prices never got back to the 1845 level. A thought for those hopeful of a revival in the dot-com stakes. But why was this? Well, I don't think it was because the railway was unsuccessful. In fact, these figures for revenue growth probably outstrip what anyone really would have guessed in the 1840s. The railway delivered a lot of business. It was a successful business in many respects. The revenue growth is both passenger and freight, and I think the freight was perhaps the pleasant surprise compared with the 1840s. To understand why the shares didn't altogether act as a jackpot, I think we can do that by turning to the economic historian's favourite idea, social savings. Social savings was introduced into our literature by Robert Fogel in his analysis of the effect of railways on the American economy or economic growth. Shortly afterwards, Gary Hawke for Britain did a very similar exercise. What's the social saving measure? Well, if it's measured accurately, it measures the benefits to the users of a new technology. And where do the benefits come from? They come from the fact that the technology makes things possible more cheaply. In the case of railways, you could ship goods more cheaply. You could travel more cheaply. Quality adjusted, you could travel hugely more cheaply if you allow for the value of time and recognise that railways delivered much faster travel. In principle, then, well measured, the social saving would be a kind of consumer surplus concept, area under the demand curve. Quite important when people have thought about where the gains from this technology go, if that's your basic idea, then a quite important set of gainers from, in this case, railways, may actually be in other countries. They may not be in the home country at all. I'll come back to that in a moment. But really, you're eager to see another graph. What you really want to see is what the social saving looked like. Your wish is my command. So if we look at the benefits from railways and we graph it out, the red line at the bottom is essentially what the owners got, what the shareholders got, call it net earnings. And the black line, excuse me, is Hawke's estimate of social savings. Tim Loynig and I at the moment are trying to unpick that, improve it, make it more reliable. However, nothing that we're doing is going to change the basic picture. And the basic picture, if you look at that, is the social saving was something of the order of 7/8, thereabouts, of the total benefits. Here is a picture which says most of the benefits accrued to the users. The users of this technology, not the innovators or the owners. Another way of making that point is just to look at what the rates of return were. Private rates of return, Hawke estimated, Terry Gourvish and others have prodded, but I think a good story is they're around 5% on capital employed in those pioneering years to 1870. The social rate of return, however, was much higher. It was about 15%. The social rate of return would include the gains to all those users. So a quite important point, I think, emerges from this. Over the years to 1870, the railway delivered a lot to the economy. This is a strong contribution. It was an important technology. The stock market was right to be hugely impressed, but wrong to imagine that most of the gains would accrue to the investors. The technology delivered. The stock market crash did not imply that it would. Here we have the second set of lessons. Lessons from railways, then. The railway mania certainly ended in tears. That's the stock crash. The profits were less than the optimists had hoped. The revenues exceeded expectations, but so, I think, did the costs. Some of that was difficulty of cost control, the costs of purchasing land. As always, construction costs seemed to be underestimated. But I think the most important feature here, and the more general one for the lessons for this evening, is that competition reduced prices. There was competition between railways in intercity travel. There was competition between railways and shipping for much of the freight business. Competition limited the extent to which market power could be exploited, even though, in the end, barriers to entry were not insignificant. But the main lesson is users gained much more than the investors. And if we look where those users were, quite a lot of them, when we try measuring social saving, were not in Britain at all. They turn out to be, in this case, Latin American developing countries. Now, the next slide, I must admit, is one that may upset people. It's one of those where I think we say viewers of a nervous disposition should turn away. Turn away now. Okay? That's where you lost your money a few years ago. The NASDAQ index, starting at about 1,000 in 96 on this chart, peaking at 5,000 5 years ago, March 2000, falling back almost to its 1996 level, and now at around 2,000. This looks a bit reminiscent, changing the numbers, of what happened with railways. Well, based on what we thought we knew about railways, let's just think then about the new economy and stock prices. What's the story? I suspect that that NASDAQ does have a bubble in it. We can argue a lot about how to measure the value of firms. I'm inclined to believe that in due course we will accept there was a bubble phenomenon. But even in that context, it came against the backgrounds of fundamentals having improved. I think we do now believe that the trend growth of the United States economy is better than it was 15 years ago, and that has a great deal to do with ICT. We see ICT continuing very rapidly to raise American productivity 5 years after the Nasdaq crash. What does that remind me of? It reminds me of railways continuing to power ahead with British productivity after the 1840s stock market crash. The dot-com's experience certainly wouldn't have surprised, I think, anyone who lived through the 1840s. The economic gains, I think, from ICT are certainly not a mirage. We saw the very strong productivity implications. I think what the stock market has started to recognize is that quite few of them may be reaped in the end by investors. Is this a general tale? Yes, I think it is. The general story of the last 50 years in the American economy is that innovation does not generate massive supernormal profits. Innovators perhaps gain something of the order of 2% of the total social gain from technological progress. They find it difficult to appropriate many of the gains. Prices fall against them, they're imitated, etc. Depreciation of inventions tends to be quite high. And yet, when one does the sums, the stock market valuations in the late 1990s seem to imply that the market thought the owners could get nearly all the social gain. What's that old cliche? Something about a triumph of hope over experience? Yeah, I think this looks like a good occasion to deploy that. And yet I would be inclined to argue that given the barriers to entry with regard to railways, it may even be that ICT will struggle to match the appropriability of that earlier technology. The social savings from ICT, I'm going to skip because I see that time is moving on. Let me turn then to the third part of the lecture, which is about globalization. Remember, my suggestion was that both STEAM and ICT are globalizing, in the sense that they enhance the integration of international markets. International markets can be made more integrated by liberalizing policy, but they can also be made more integrated by reductions in transport and communications costs. And that seems to me to be a common feature of these two technologies. But with today's worries in mind, the question I think I'd want you to think about at that stage is, as these transport costs fall, does everything tend to disappear to the far corners of the globe? This is the sort of offshoring nightmare that one or two American congressmen seemed delighted to play on in the election. Or is the effect, on the contrary, to tend to centralize, to favor agglomeration? Theory's a bit indecisive about this. We can think of two cases quite easily. If costs are very, very high, markets are served by their own suppliers. Activity has to be dispersed. If these costs are very, very, very low, once again, activity has to be dispersed. Why would you ever pay for more expensive real estate if you can transport things for free, including people, and if you like, we have Star Trek technology. You know, beam me up, Scotty, becomes a reality. This would transform university education, incidentally. I can't wait for this technology to appear, make a whole difference to office hours. When I sit there for an hour and a half with no punters, I can beam myself back home for a bit and be called up at the drop of a hat. It's the intermediate case, of course, which is interesting, where the technology may be such, or the transport costs may be such, as to favor agglomeration. Agglomeration which exploits various kinds of increasing return or economies of scale, and perhaps linkage effects. Externalities are involved, closeness to suppliers and producers, thick labor markets, all those sorts of things. It may be more possible to exploit them when transport and communication costs fall. Okay, with that in mind, let's think what steam power did. I think those are the main things that we would pick out of the steam power period. It does reduce transport costs, and it reduces them particularly for goods, whereas some of today's technology is reducing costs for services. Industry was able, quite profitably in many cases, to move closer to its natural resources. Think of all the things located on coal fields. Big cities often became manufacturing cities. New York and London were manufacturing cities in the late 19th century, though we don't think of them today. Manufacturing cities proliferated. I think that is, generally speaking, a set of things which are centralizing. But the changes there are not the changes of the 21st century. Cities are different now, it's services, not manufacturing, and so on. What did railways do for city size? This is work I'm doing with Tim at the moment, and it's a bit provisional. But I suspect that what we get is a productivity effect there. Railways make possible bigger cities, and productivity rises as cities get bigger. Population within about 80 minutes of a city seems, in effect, to be part of the city labour market. In 1906, that suggests that population within about 30 kilometres of a city centre were important for its productivity. In 1840, perhaps 6 kilometres. If that view is right, and you heard it here first, there is a substantial possibility that railways had bigger social returns than I was mentioning earlier. There may be externalities excluded from the standard story. You'll also want to know that shipping got cheaper. Shipping got cheaper substantially in the late 19th century. Real costs of shipping estimated by Nick Harley are something like a third in 1910 of what they had been in 1750. What did this all imply for the British economy? Well, I think, first of all, there are sectors of the economy it definitely helps. Broadly speaking, Britain is going to become even more specialised. Manufacturing gets still larger. Manufacturing's growth is at the expense of agriculture's contraction. That's the specialisation change. Globalisation in that period comes with some investment opportunities, particularly in things like foreign railroads, and the city gains. Who hurts? Well, agriculture, or part of agriculture. Arable agriculture in East Anglia and the land rents from it. But I think the most important thing I want you to pick out here is that this episode did not destroy the Lancashire cotton textile industry. Some of that is certainly because of the cushion of India and empire. But even in third markets, Lancashire hangs on for a very long time. What's the reason? Well, it can't be low labour costs. Low labour costs are not Lancashire's advantage by 1880 or 1900. And the reductions in transport costs, you'd think, would simply get Lancashire exposed to cheap labour abroad. I think it is these Marshallian industrial district aspects. It's these externalities. It's the proximity to the textile engineering industry, the marketing, the merchandising, and so on. Those, I suspect, are the things that sustain Lancashire's position for far longer than a simple factor endowment argument familiar to international economists would suppose. Steam-powered globalisation also probably had some impacts on wage gaps. Of itself, its direct effect was probably to help British workers relative to American. What was spectacular was the change in wheat prices. And here's where East Anglia gets hit. East Anglia's hit comes from the much reduced price of wheat. If you're good at arithmetic and look at the two columns together, you'll see that what's happening is not a reduced price of wheat in Chicago. It's a reduced price of delivering it to Liverpool that's making the big difference. In the United States, these changes lead to mass production and mass distribution. That's your Chandler story of American business history, based on the integration of the market. The story is then that those transport cost changes, I think, are basically centralizing rather than dispersing. If we looked more widely, we'd see that they foster industrialization in the West combined with deindustrialization in the East. These are transport cost changes which favor centralization on balance, I think. But what about ICT? Well, the worries about ICT are clearly that it leads to a lot more outsourcing and indeed is facilitating wholly new trades in business services, including the infamous, but I would say mutually beneficial, offshoring. That isn't, however, to say that everything or even most things can be offshored, nor is it the case that the transportation of people is noticeably getting a lot cheaper. Cities survive partly because it is very advantageous to have lots of the right people close together. At the same time, it is certainly a frightening thought to see how different wage costs are around the world. These are manufacturing wage costs. They wouldn't quite compare for doing software projects in different countries. They do make the point that if ICT is accessing much cheaper labour in Asia, there clearly are going to be some changes in economic geography. What's the story? I think the story of the offshoring is there are gains for both countries involved in the process, but some individuals lose their jobs or lose their rents to skills. Business costs are definitely reduced, and real wages in the West go up as prices fall. Having said this, we ought to be a bit careful. Imports of these kinds of services, even in the US, are less than 0.5% of GDP in recent years. And the evidence certainly does suggest that the American labour market has perfectly successfully recycled the workers who have lost their jobs, perhaps at slightly slower wages, but basically not without employment. And in that context, the crucial thing to bear in mind is that distance still matters. Lots of trades can't be done at distance. Lots of investments can't even be very well done at distance. This graph suggests how trade and foreign direct investment fall off as distance increases. It's basically a gravity model story. That graph tells me that distance still matters. If ICT had really had the effects that those who have the nightmare stories about offshoring would offer, those economic interactions would basically be pretty similar at all distances. In fact, apart from the people I've been teaching this year and fans of Steve Redding and Tony Venables, it's a little known fact that most of cross-country income variation seems to have a very strong input from location, where you are on the globe relative to other countries. Even when you have taken account of institutions, all the obvious control variables you might like, there still seems to be a very strong geographic effect of being far away from markets. It is still a big penalty. Move closer to your trading partners by 50%, income might rise by 25%. And in that context, the Redding and Venables measures of market access do suggest huge disparities around the world. We could make that a lot bigger if we looked at individual countries, but even on a continent basis, Africa compared with North America is hugely different. So what did the third part say? Well, the third part said, essentially, that the death of distance was a myth. The death of distance would indeed have a truly dramatic effect on the world. If it occurred, economic activity would be much more widely dispersed. Incomes, I suspect, would look rather more equal. But the slides I've shown you suggest to me that this death is greatly exaggerated. ICT certainly helps some things go to the periphery. But in doing so, it's strengthening the core at the same time. Think of London as a financial centre, the data processing dispersed, the deal-making centralised. So my message would be at the end, like steam, ICT is rearranging geography, but it isn't eliminating distance, and it doesn't abolish geography. So that was the third lesson. You recall my mission statement at the start. We'd better have a final slide suggesting, this is our sales pitch as a department, of course, who should really do a course in economic history. Well, I've got several candidates here. I'm going to be kind. How about these three? Sadder but wiser investors who lost their savings in the dot-com boom. I think a course on railway history in the 1840s would be ideal for them. Growth economists baffled by the Solow productivity paradox. I think they need a course in the Industrial Revolution, perhaps from me, but probably from almost anybody else. Any half-decent economic historian could have solved that problem for them. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, protectionist politicians who believe that offshoring will undermine our prosperity. On the contrary, freer trade of this kind will tend to raise incomes. I think they need a course on British tariff history. From one of my eminent colleagues. And on that, I'll finish.
Nick, thank you very much for that illuminating discussion of comparisons between steam technology and ICT. We have about 15 minutes for questions. The floor is yours, so please ask. I've got a microphone.
Yeah, so are the benevolent advisor investors asking for benevolence, because do you think that the stock market boom is necessary for the integration of technologies that are going to be kind of implicit is that they occur right at the point where that technology becomes very useful for them?
This is maybe. Maybe it's easier if I stand up, Alex.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Essentially, what you might say is, if the investors of the 1840s had seen how difficult it would be to make money out of railways, they might have been a lot less enthusiastic about the project. This triumph of hope over experience brings things to market relatively quickly, and it does seem to finance a strong investment at that point. I think the other point that might be made, and it goes back to the Nordhaus slide, is you probably don't need huge supernormal profits actually to get a lot of very useful invention. You need a bit. I think that's what exactly what the literature on British innovations is telling us at the moment. The literature on competition, on Schumpeter and so on. You need some market imperfections, or it never will be worthwhile to invent. But you don't need a huge amount of market power. If you have too much market power, you end up getting sleepy. And I think that's a tale we could tell from the later period of British railway companies. In the later 19th century, there are some serious signs of sleepiness, I believe, and I've written a paper on that recently. So competition is basically delivering the goods to the punters. We need some imperfections in competition to entice the investors in. They need to make something, but they don't need to make jackpot profits for a long time to keep what we might call the capitalist innovation machine running. Yes, sounds like Prince Charles's favourite question, doesn't it? I don't know. If I did, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be trying to exploit them. I think in a way that's the point historically, that it is not obvious when something is going to be a general purpose technology, at least it's typically not obvious at the outset. That was my point about it being very slow to gather pace and so on. I think, for example, Paul will probably correct me, when we had the centenary here in 1995, we had in the department lots of posters about failed prophecies from economic history, and one of them I seem to recall was about computers. And this suggested that the total market for mainframe computers in the world would sum to about 20. And I think the date of that prediction was somewhere around 1946 or something of that sort. People just do not see, and I can't see into the future, where technologies are going to lead. For example, when radio was invented, it was basically thought of as a device to communicate between ship and shore. And very useful it was at that. But it had a great deal more potential than that. So, I mean, I think we see both false dawns and technologies that come along and far surpass anything that is thought of in their early days. So I'll leave it to others around the room to talk about nanotechnology or whatever it is you think is the coming GPT, and I'll reluctantly decline to answer a question I wish I was smart enough to cope with.
A lot has been written about whether ICTs can help poor people in developing countries. I'd like to ask, based on your experience of railways and steam, do you think the benefits of ICTs will go to the poor people in developing countries, or do you think it will mainly help the already industrialized class? Thank you.
Good question. I think what you would be saying about that steam-powered technology is it did help poor people as well as rich. The transport improvements in improving markets had terms of trade effects and so on. Eventually, things like rail transport became a viable alternative for people whose original possibility was basically walking. You know, so that walking is the alternative to what's eventually an ability to ride on a train or the later developments into trams or whatever it might be. If we look at ICT at the moment, there is quite a lot of work on diffusion across countries, and certainly it was at the back of my talk to suggest diffusion is important. If you look at what the obstacles are, then I suspect the obstacles to acquiring the technology in the short term, many of them, are to do primarily now with income, which I think lies at the back of your question. Yes, we can certainly look at, and there are diffusion models where people talk, for example, about the effects of regulation. We can look at availability of infrastructure and expense of telecoms and so on. And certainly those have been factors which have held up diffusion in the early period in many countries, but including especially some developing countries. If you then, however, try to estimate some kind of diffusion model, a paper last year by Chin, which appeared in the National Bureau of Economic Research Working Papers series, says, actually, in the end, these look quite small compared with the income to buy the equipment. So insofar as equipment is required, it may still be expensive relative to the wages which a poor person is going to receive in a third world country. So I think we are, in that context, talking about a period in which there will be something of a digital divide, if you like that kind of terminology.
Thanks. Given that, as you demonstrate, the benefits of new technologies accrue more to the users than to the investors, and given that, as you say, it's difficult to know what new technologies will succeed, what would be your advice to public policymakers concerned with innovation and investment, if any?
Well, I think, first of all, public policymakers may be able to do more in the context of diffusion than invention, and that some of the more successful public technology policies in the post-war period probably have been designed to facilitate more rapid diffusion. In other words, policies which are geared at technology transfer, if you wish. You know, that turns out to be by far the most important thing for most countries who don't invent their own technologies. If we're talking about the invention process itself, then I think we should recognize that there are reasons to believe that the gains from R&D, let's say, are much larger than accrue to the people doing it. There is a divergence between social and private return. I think that was implicit, though I didn't make it explicit in the talk. In that context, that does suggest there is reason to believe that markets can be improved upon, you know, that market failure is something to worry about, and that well-targeted subsidies to R&D may be a perfectly appropriate part of a government's policy package. Maybe alternatively, it's R&D tax credits that one thinks about. But those kinds of interventions do seem to me to have more rationale in the context of growth economics than old-fashioned subsidies simply to physical investment or something of the sort. The other thing I think I'd say, but this is perhaps a Brit speaking rather than for everybody concerned, is on the whole I'd prefer that government didn't itself try and pick the winners. Subsidizing the process of R&D may be good news. Government deciding on which projects to support has typically been bad news. I mentioned Concorde on the way through the talk. I don't think Concorde is totally atypical. I think there is a white elephant phenomenon to be worried about and to be feared there. So I'm not really keen on suggesting that our Prime Minister has a commission for technology or something of that sort. I think lower level, more quiet, if you like, adjustments of the Brown type to the tax regime might be more the way to go.
Hi. How do you measure social benefits, and does it take into account all income groups?
With difficulty is obviously the answer. I think one can measure them in the context of what I call social saving, reasonably straightforwardly, if we have information on the price that the technology is available for, and what the economist would call, if you like, the slope of the demand curve. we need to know something about how sensitive demand is to price. If we do that, then we certainly can, in principle, look at society's willingness to pay for what is on offer, and using the information on willingness to pay, which would be in the demand curve, we could get some kind of aggregate measure. Even then, I think we've got to be very careful. A difficulty that I'd glossed over in the talk is how exactly to handle new goods, which are imperfect substitutes for the old goods. Put simply, I think that says we need to be very careful about differences in quality, and we need to be very careful about new characteristics of goods which were not available before. So trains, for example, allowed you to go much quicker than any other previous method of inland travel, etc. I think you may be asking something a bit additional to that, though. The question then might be, how do we allow for distributional effects? In other words, you might well say, I can see in the aggregate there's a big social saving, but if the classes of the population in which I'm most interested were too poor to participate, no gains accrue to them. I think then one has the opportunity of actually asking, if there's enough information, who is benefiting, which are the income groups who can benefit. And if one were trying to do a social cost-benefit analysis, perfectly entitled if we wish, then to nominate our value judgments and say, we will look at the gains in the context of weighting the gains to different groups in different ways. And that can, of course, then inform, if we want, our public investment decisions as to how to take forward the technology. So I think you're telling me off quite right. I was a bit glib about how we measure the benefits. I have thought about these difficulties. I think what I offered you is a reasonable shorthand first approximation. I think that for a historian, actually that may be almost as much as you can do, because I don't think you probably in the end are going to have the really detailed information very often to answer fully the distributional question. But I take your point, and distribution certainly shouldn't be ignored.
Nick, there are at least two lots of social benefits that we are deriving from this evening's meeting. The first, most obviously, is to listen to your talk, to think about it. We accept it's not professional financial advice, but we will bear in mind what, you know, we'll draw certain lessons when the stock market races up again. So one set of social benefits for us all is intellectual. There's a second set of social benefits because there is a reception which I'd like to invite all of you to come to. It's in the Student Services Centre, the LSE atrium. So if you go back up the road, in through the LSE main entrance and round to the right, we can have some refreshments. I fear, Nick, the refreshments aren't beer. It may be wine instead, but it will be some recompense for all the talk you've done. Nick, thanks very much.
You think I hit the time just again?